Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Britain gets a new prime minister today, Theresa May. She has her hands full even before she digs in. Last month, the British, in a 52-48% vote, asked to leave the European Union to take the Brexit. Theresa May opposed the Brexit, a defeat for elites, the pundits now say, but she has vowed to implement it with all its daunting economic challenges and big implications for immigration, even the very union of the United Kingdom. This hour On Point, British leader Theresa May and her challenges in the Brexit. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see coming for the UK on its own? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The day after Britain's historic vote to leave the European Union, June 23rd, British Prime Minister David Cameron announced he would be stepping down from his position.
I will do everything I can as Prime Minister to steady the ship over the coming weeks and months. But I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination.
There was a scramble. Theresa May, Home Secretary for a long time, came out on top. On June 30th, she launched her bid for Conservative leadership with hopes of being the successor to Cameron.
I know I'm not a showy politician. I don't tour the television studios. I don't gossip about people over lunch. I don't go drinking in Parliament's bars. I don't often wear my heart on my sleeve. Just get on with the job in front of me.
And though she, like Cameron, had opposed the Brexit, she said the vote had been taken and the Brexit will happen.
Brexit means Brexit. The campaign was fought, the vote was held, turnout was high, and the public gave their verdict. There must be no attempts to remain inside the EU, no attempts to rejoin it through the back door, and no second referendum.
No second referendum. Joining me now from London is Heather Stewart, political editor at The Guardian. Heather, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi.
How did Theresa May come out on top? We saw Boris Johnson and several others who appeared to be vying at one point for 10 Downing Street.
Yeah, it's been a bit of an extraordinary ride, really. And then the expectation was that someone who had backed the idea of Brexit and campaigned for it might well come out on top. But in fact, so Boris Johnson we're expecting to stand. And then one of his close colleagues in the Vote Leave campaign, Michael Gove, another government mm-hmm. minister, at the very last minute declared his own candidacy. A lot of Boris Johnson's supporters immediately leapt to Michael Gove in what was seen as an act of sort of treachery by him to sort of, you know, persuade Boris Johnson not to stand. Johnson gave an extraordinary sort of speech at which we all went along expecting him to launch his candidacy. And, you know, he gave this sort of barnstorming speech which ended, you know, and I'm not the man for the job.
Yeah.
So he pulls out and then Conservative MPs, Conservative lawmakers feel quite angry with Michael Gove for standing. So not many of them back him. There was another woman, Andrea Leadsom, who was a Brexiteer, as we call it, who also stood. And then she dramatically pulled out over the weekend after making some rather unguarded, unwise comments about the fact that she thought that being a mother made her a better candidate than the eventual winner, Theresa May.
Fact that Theresa May does not have children,
absolutely.
An odd thing perhaps to come up. Introduce us to Theresa May. Describe her for us. The last female British Prime Minister, of course, and the first, Margaret Thatcher. That comes to mind. Introduce us to Theresa May.
Indeed. So as you heard there in that little clip, she's not one of the showier, more charismatic, more sort of out there politicians in Westminster. She's viewed as a very safe pair of hands. She has been in her post. She's one of the few ministers who've been in her post all the way since 2010 when David Cameron first became Prime Minister. And the Home Office, the department she's in charge of, is seen as a sort of notorious graveyard of political careers. You know, she's in charge of the police. She's in charge of of immigration, a lot of difficult areas and difficult decisions were, that can sort of trip people up. And she's managed to sort of quietly and calmly steer that department, you know, without many slip-ups and without sort of any unfortunate headlines. In fact, sometimes she keeps herself out of the headlines, and, you know, that's a skill in itself.
Has she sat down with the Queen as we speak today? Is that part of the
day's... Not yet, mm-hmm. but she will later on. So, first of all, so David Cameron is expected to give a few remarks later on outside 10 Downing Street, which has been his home since 2010. He will then go to Buckingham Palace to talk to the Queen to declare his resignation. Theresa May will then go to the Queen herself and be asked to form a government, which is a sort of formality. It's more about pageantry these days than anything else, but it's a process known as kissing hands. So she will go and see the Queen, and she will be then officially declared Prime Minister.
And what's the sense of Theresa May coming in? I mean, people have talked about a whiff of panic since the Brexit happened. There was some voters' remorse, others glad to see it come, lots of uncertainty about the road ahead, whether Scotland would stay in, and so on. The economy, do people have the sense that these are steady hands? She's up to it, or open question?
I think that's absolutely right. And actually, in the days afterwards, while Boris Johnson, for example, the former mayor of London, was seen as he's a very flamboyant, charismatic character, and he was key to the persuading voters to vote for Brexit. But actually, there were some concerns about whether he had the ministerial experience and the grasp of detail and the sort of heft to be able to steer these extremely difficult and complicated negotiations that we now face.
She has said she will dive into those. The Brexit will happen, but not until the beginning of next year. Is Europe, do they have any choice but to wait?
Well, so there is a formal process. It's known as Article 50, is a sort of technical term, which is a kind of formal official request to the other European Union member states to open up negotiations on Britain's withdrawal. David Cameron had said that he would trigger that. He would kind of press that button immediately. He then came out on Downing Street the morning after and said he wouldn't. It's not clear exactly when Theresa May will do it, but she has said she wants to appoint a minister for Brexit, someone to lead these negotiations, probably someone who advocated leaving. And I think she wants to become clearer about what sort of deal she would like to do with the other 27 member states before she starts that formal process. But certainly work will start immediately, I think, on what the sort of framework for any kind of deal might be, what Britain might ask for, and what it might be likely to get.
Monumental negotiations to come there with huge implications for what Britain will look like on the other side and its relations with Europe and well beyond. Heather Stewart, political editor at The Guardian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On June 15th, about a week before Britain voted to leave the EU, Theresa May told the BBC why she was in favour of remaining in the European Union.
I do believe that there are risks and uncertainties about a Brexit vote in terms of our economy. I think people's jobs would be at risk. And then security, obviously as Home Secretary, that's a key issue for me. And I genuinely believe from everything I've seen over the last 6 years as Home Secretary that we would be more secure and safer inside the European Union.
But Britain's voted 52-48% to leave, and now she will oversee that exit, that Brexit. Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times, joins us now from London. Lionel, welcome back to One Point. Thank you very much for being here today.
Good to be here.
How do you see the major challenges now in front of Theresa May?
I think the challenges are on a scale, the same scale as 1979, when Margaret Thatcher took over as Prime Minister amidst industrial chaos, with the trade unions on strike, rubbish in the streets, very weak government. And she had to produce a whole new reform agenda and revive the country. Some people are actually even likening it to the scale of challenge in 1940 when Churchill took over and Hitler had invaded France and was threatening to overrun Britain. That's probably a bit far-fetched, but this is a really serious moment in British history. You mentioned the threat to the integrity of the Union caused by Scotland voting yes to remain, the rest of the country no. And it means that Britain has to reconstitute its relationship with Europe. And of course, the point that hasn't been emphasized enough yet in this program mm-hmm. is that the Leave campaign fought a brilliant campaign around immigration and the supposed level of cost that the European membership entailed, but they had no plan. There was no concrete plan for what the new relationship would mean or life after Brexit. And that is what Theresa May is having to put together, and it's why she's not going to trigger Article 50, that irrevocable decision, for at least 4 or 6 months, because they need to have time to constitute a plan.
The critique was, as soon as the vote was taken, okay, here we are now, and there's no idea how to move forward. Does she have an idea? Who's going to help her figure it out?
She has to put forward now a new cabinet. She's, by the way, not a very good delegator. Mm. She's a details person, but she's got to get put together the new cabinet. There will be a minister for Brexit. That person has got to negotiate with the other Europeans and the European Commission. It's going to require toughness but deftness, because again, we in London, we risk missing the point here, that it's not just what we want, it's what the Europeans are willing to give us. So it's a very, very difficult challenge. And meanwhile, the economic threat in terms of uncertainty, in terms of the markets, that's looming in the background. And just tomorrow, the Bank of England may well cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point in order to preempt any further risks. Now, I don't want to exaggerate the market turmoil. Obviously, in the first few days, it was serious. Sterling collapsed. It's come back a bit on the May factor, but it's still out there. Will we move into a recession in the next two quarters?
We'll look in more detail, but what's the heart of the negotiations going to be? What's the toughest nut for Europe and the UK now to address?
There's a whole package of nuts, and they're very large nuts. There's a trade nut, for example. I'm using this this nut metaphor. Okay. It's totally out of control, by the way.
It's nutty.
But Brazil nuts, hazelnuts. We've got lots of nuts here. Look, you've got to think about, are we going to want, if you like, a soft Brexit, where we want full access to the single European market? Mm-hmm. Got to think about our financial services industry. And meanwhile, what's the balance on immigration? You know, if we start to say, well, we're pulling up the drawbridge and it's going to be a narrow, inward-looking, nativist Britain, that's very bad. And so therefore, already some Brexiters are saying, actually, we do need some immigration, because we can't just throw out all the EU immigrants in England. We need that labour. So it's a balance.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the woman who will lead Britain into its new era outside the EU, Theresa May, and the challenges the UK's brand new prime minister will face with all those negotiations in front of her now. Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times, is with us from London. You can join us as well. What do you think? Can Britain have the benefits of Europe and not the membership? About half the country wanted to stay in the EU, a little more than half wanted out. So what now? Here's Theresa May talking about immigration. She's been right at the heart of this. This was last October. She gave a speech to the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, England. Of course, she is of the Conservative Party. She warned about the urgency to cut back on immigration. She said Britain did not need hundreds of thousands of people migrating in each year.
While there are benefits of selective and controlled immigration, at best, the net economic and fiscal effect of high immigration is close to zero. So there is no case in the national interest for immigration of the scale we have experienced over the last decade.
No place for that kind of immigration, but she was talking a bit of a softer line on Sunday with ITV about immigration and the Brexit.
Of course, as part of the negotiation, we will need to look at this question of people who are here in the UK from the EU. And I want to ensure that we're able to not just guarantee the position for those people, but guarantee the position for British citizens who are over in other member states, in other countries in Europe and living there.
Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times, is with us from London. From Washington, David Rennie is here, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. David Rennie, thank you for joining us as well.
Hello, Tom.
Lionel Barber's begun to take us into this immigration question. What about it? Many have come. Many have said that was a big part of the reason that so many Britons voted against the EU membership. What are the implications of trying to turn the screws on that now? Can she turn it down? Will she be sending people out of the country, David?
Well, I think that what people need to understand in America is, as Lionel says quite rightly, this is a gigantic, complex negotiation. It's made still more nightmarish for the new prime minister, because essentially 17 million British people voted in this referendum to send an absolutely clear message to the ruling classes that they want something impossible. What they want is to have their cake and eat it. What they want is to have as much as possible the ability for British factories to make stuff and sell it freely into European markets, which is still almost half of all our exports go to Europe. But they don't want European workers to have the absolute right to come into Britain's labour markets. We want to be able to pick and choose and be much more selective about who we want in. But here's the problem. As Lionel says, absolutely rightly, the British are very focused on what Britain wants and what British voters want. And the Leave campaign did a brilliant job of stoking the resentment of British workers, who are also unhappy about things like globalisation and general kind of cultural change in the way that the world feels. But here's the problem. There's politics on the other side of the English Channel too.
Of course.
There's governments who have to answer their own voters. And specifically, you have rich and poorer countries in the European Union. The richer companies with very strong company, the richer countries with very strong kind of businesses that can make things very efficiently, the kind of Volkswagens and Daimlers, Mercedes of this world. Of course, they want it all to be about markets and the right to sell their products into, you know, even the poorest corners of the European Union without barriers. But if you're one of the poorer countries, and they get a vote too in this, what they have to offer is cheap labour. What they have to offer is all those highly motivated, hardworking Polish workers who want to be able to move to somewhere like the UK, earn money and send it home to their families. And so that's part of the deal for them.
So, Lionel Barber, if it's something impossible that's been promised, where does the immovable meet the immovable here? EU members will say you will not have trade access, full trade access to our markets if you don't continue to take this flow of people. And then Theresa May says what?
I haven't figured out the Rubik's Cube here. What I do know is that we are not going to be able to have full access to the single market without agreeing to the free movement. And that's unequivocal of people, labor. But maybe if you take out some, you go a couple of notches down on the single market, maybe you then get some guarantees that it's not an absolute commitment to free labor. Remember, in the negotiations which David Cameron had before putting his package and the question of European Union membership to the British people, he tried to secure what was called an emergency break on high levels of immigration. And the European Union leaders, for the reasons that David described, because the Southern Europeans were important here, Eastern Europeans, they weren't prepared to give him that out. I reckon, actually, that if he got that emergency break, he might have even won the referendum, but he didn't. So it's going to be a trade-off. I just want to make another point about Theresa May's that recorded statement for her. Actually, she'd walked back from something rather silly that she said late last week, which was calling into question the number of EU workers already here. She was told in no unequivocal terms that actually that would really put at risk British citizens living in Europe. And again, I think there's going to be a compromise here. Frankly, they'll grandfather it. They'll allow people who are working in Britain to stay. It's going to be about the future.
David Rennie, Theresa May has been hawkish on immigration. You might describe for our listeners just how that's played out as she's been Home Secretary. Can she now say, oh, never mind, the immigrants who are here can stay, and even though if you voted for Brexit, you'll be all right with that, won't you?
So if you talk to supporters of Theresa May, they will tell you that she's not kind of instinctively a bigot or a racist or a kind of panderer to nativism. They will tell you that the key to Theresa May's politics is that she's not especially an ideological person. She's not driven by kind of, you know, deep-seated kind of doctrinaire beliefs, but that she is someone who wants the Conservative Party to have the broadest possible support. And sometimes that actually pushes her to sound quite left-wing. So, for example, she was one of the earliest big-name Conservatives to support gay marriage, and that was about broadening the party's appeal in that direction. And she has always said, and in that speech, and you're right, there were some ugly bits in that conference speech from 2015, she presented it as, if we want to have a cohesive society, if we want low-income workers to feel that they have a sort of chance of a decent-paying job, then we have to do something really tough about immigration. So her defenders will say she's not a kind of ugly nativist. She just wants to build a cohesive society and broaden the Conservative Party's appeal, and that's what made her a hardliner on immigration. So if you're a real optimist, when she goes into those negotiations that Lionel describes accurately will be a kind of whole series of compromises, she is more pragmatic than some of the people you could have as British Prime Minister. But the problem is that the British people have been promised something fairly dramatic when it comes to free movement. And as Lionel points out, when David Cameron tried something much, much milder than that to stave off the disaster of the Brexit vote, he didn't get it. Other Europeans just can't start to unpick that package. And I think that is the, you know, that is going to be the sticking point, that even if Theresa May is more pragmatic than many other people who might have got that job, there are real limits to what she can do before the Tory party that's currently cheering her to the rafters turns on her too.
Lionel Barber, we just have you for another minute. Do you see in this new prime minister the temperament, the capacity to pull off this, what David and others describe as almost impossible mission?
We don't know a lot about Theresa May. We know she's a cool customer. She's very tough. One of the most striking examples was when she resisted enormous American pressure to extradite Gary McKinnon, the illegal computer hacker. And, I mean, she is also known as probably the only person in cabinet, this is the cabinet minister told me this, that actually was prepared to say no to David Cameron to the face. And she had a couple of colourful nicknames, which I couldn't possibly repeat on the air as a result of that. Has she got the temperament? Has she got the nuts? She doesn't have a plan. We need to know what this plan will be. What are the trade-offs? I think she's tough enough. She's going to be severely tested. And my view is that of all the outcomes, you know, a Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the sort of flamboyant Lothario with the blonde, permanently disheveled blonde, who at one point was for Remain and then became a Leaver. You know, you have Lendra Leadsom, who just dropped out over the weekend, manifestly unqualified for the job, and Michael Gove, whose heart was never really in it. Of all the outcomes, you're probably best with Theresa May, but we don't. She's an unknown quantity.
Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times in London. Thank you very much for joining us today, Lionel.
It's really good to be back. Thanks.
David Rennie, please stand by with The Economist in Washington. With us as well now from Manchester, England, is Anand Menon. He's director of the UK in a Changing Europe initiative, that's for sure, explores the shifting relationship between the UK and the European Union, professor of European politics and foreign affairs at King's College in London. Anand Menon, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
One question is how Britain now works out a relationship with continental Europe. The other is how it deals with its own internal division. This was a rather close vote if you step way back, 52-48% for such a very large decision. How does Theresa May begin to heal that? You say the referendum revealed a riven country. How does she pull it together?
Well, you're absolutely right. The vote revealed a very, very divided society. And one of the challenges facing the new government is how to take on board the views and opinions of a whole group of people who got involved in this referendum who don't normally participate in our politics. What was very, very striking was where big areas of the country where turnout in our national elections is below average, there was an above average turnout to vote for Leave in this referendum. And one of the questions is, if all these sort of people who aren't generally stakeholders in our political system are expressing opinions, is there a way of involving them in the negotiations to come, so at the very least we as a country can formulate a position for ourselves?
Do you see the union holding together? Scotland had a strong majority that wanted to stay with Europe.
Well, that's absolutely true, as did Northern Ireland. I've always been one of those people slightly cynical about the easy claim that Scotland will vote to leave. It strikes me that if you believe, as I do, that fear of the economic consequences played a big part in preventing Scotland from voting for independence last time, it strikes me that the economic consequences for them of trying to leave when we're outside the European Union would be worse still. So I suspect that even if they hold a vote, which is far from certain, it is very, very unlikely that the Scots will vote for independence. And that's purely a personal opinion, and I've been proven wrong before.
David Rennie, maybe the Scots would look at it and say, well, there's economic opportunity here. If London's going to be outside the EU, maybe we leave the United Kingdom, stay in the EU, and financial services come to Edinburgh, Glasgow.
Well, I think that the politics has certainly got stronger for a Leave vote, but I think actually the economics are tough. Remember that one of the big arguments when they were deciding whether to leave, when they had their vote a couple of years ago, was the people saying this is a dangerous move were pointing to the fact that you had these very, very optimistic assumptions about how much money an independent Scotland would have. And a lot of that came from the idea that there was still tons of oil in the North Sea and that they had a very high oil price. Oil price has collapsed since then. It's come back a little bit, but it's nowhere near the levels they would need. And you're right that Edinburgh has its own ambitions to be a kind of banking centre, a financial centre. And if you go back a decade, the Scottish independence crew would say, look at Iceland, look at Ireland, these sort of roving little islands that can sort of zoom around in the north of the Atlantic and be these kind of whizzy financial centres. Well, since then, Iceland and Ireland both blew up spectacularly. So that's a less appealing model. So it may be that the politics points towards the exits, but the economics means that it's going to be quite a while. Actually, it's a pretty scary prospect.
Let's go to our listeners, if I may. Jake in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Jake. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question for your panelists is this. Prior to the EU being founded, the UK had trade relationships, treaties, business relationships with the rest of Europe. Could that possibly form a model for going forward at this point?
What does history tell us here? Anand, what do you say?
Well, I think it's very important to grasp just what the difference between normal trade relations and being part of a single market is. This isn't, membership of the European Union isn't about not having tariffs. It's about the fact that we try and approximate our rules so that a company from Britain can set up in Lisbon as easily as they can in Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And that's a far, far more complicated undertaking. And it's that that's at stake when we talk about the single market. Tariffs are largely a secondary issue.
So, David, the question remains, I suppose. The Leave campaigners suggested that Britain could continue to have full, deep, rich economic relations with the continent without being in the EU. Can it have sufficient depth of interaction to keep its economy where the British are comfortable?
That's right. I mean, one of the tragedies is, I mean, you look at a place like Sunderland, which is a town in the north of England, which voted very, very strongly to leave. The single biggest thing in Sunderland in economic terms is they have a gigantic car plant, one of the largest car plants in Europe, which makes Nissan cars. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those Nissan cars are sold into Europe at the moment because the single market, a Nissan car made in the UK has the kind of perfect right to be sold anywhere else in the rest of the European Union.
Drive it right over and off you go.
And the 28 countries of the European Union, you have one set of regulations about, you know, what's a safe headlight, what's a safe fender, what's the right emissions from the exhaust pipes. And, you know, governments that have their own car companies to protect in, say, Spain or Portugal, they don't have the ability to invent a rule about, say, you know, emissions or headlights to try and keep out a British-made Nissan. Now, if you're Nissan headquarters in Japan, trying to work out, does that factory in Sunderland still make sense in 5-10 years' time? We just don't know the answer to the question, will they have the perfect right to sell that car into Europe? If Europe changes the emissions rules in 5 years' time, will Britain automatically follow suit, even though it won't have a vote in that discussion? Because if they don't, then suddenly can that Nissan made in Sunderland be sold in Spain or Portugal? It's all of those kind of more subtle barriers that really put into kind of doubt the whole economic model. And the tragedy is that the Leave camp lied through their teeth to British voters and said that Europe would never do anything to in any way limit trade, even if Britain went down a route of trying to be cheaper and more competitive and undercutting European competition. And the big lie they told was that because Europe sells more into Britain than Britain sells into Europe, then somehow it was more in Europe's interest to give us the sweet deal. But that's just bad maths. I mean, I buy more from Safeways than Safeways sells to me, but that does not give me the whip hand in that relationship because it also matters scale. And the scale is that Britain sells 45% of its exports into Europe. Britain only represents something like 13%, if that, of Europe's total exports in, you know, the other way. So we simply can't have our cake and eat it and expect to be, you know, in total control of this negotiation.
Anand, I want to come back and look at Europe's interests here, but in a word, do you see Europe now, what are their incentives, to punish or exile or deal with Theresa May in the UK?
Well, ultimately, I think the other European states want to get this done and dusted. What is interesting, though, is that since we voted to leave, initially after we voted to leave, there was a real sense of urgency. And I think in some European capitals now, there's a realization that we're suffering quite badly. The country looks in a bit of a mess. And they're almost sort of holding us up as a salutary lesson to their own Eurosceptics. One of the interesting things since our vote is there's been a firming up of support for membership in other EU member states. And I think incumbent governments rather like that. But nevertheless, despite the fact that we are this salutary lesson, I think ultimately they want to sign us off. They want to get the Article 50 process done and dusted so they can move on and deal with the real problems that are dominating their agenda, like the migration crisis, like the Eurozone crisis, the Italian banks. They've got more than enough on their plate without worrying too much about detailed technical negotiations with us.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Britain's brand new Prime Minister, Theresa May, and the challenges she faces with the UK leaving the EU, taking the Brexit. David Rennie is with us, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Anand Menon is with us from Manchester, England, professor there of European politics, foreign affairs at King's College in London as well. You can join us this hour. What do you see coming for the UK on its own, sort of on its own? On Monday, Theresa May said she was honored and humbled to have been chosen by her party to lead. Need a strong new vision, she said.
We need a strong, new, positive vision for the future of our country. A vision of a country that works not for the privileged few, but that works for every one of us. Because we're going to give people more control over their lives. And that's how, together, we will build a better Britain.
Theresa May on Monday. And on Menon, we hear a lot of rhetoric in this country in this campaign season from Donald Trump in particular about immigration and about cutting back on it, about even pushing people out. Do you hear echoes back and forth across the pond when it comes to immigration and what the UK will now wrestle with as they deal with economic realities and maybe cultural resistance?
Well, I think there are all sorts of really interesting similarities between our side and your side of the pond at the moment in terms of politics. And yes, immigration is definitely one of them. And our situation is made even more complicated because, as some of your earlier contributors were saying, if we want to control immigration from the rest of Europe, we're going to have to sacrifice something in return because EU rules stipulate if you want the market, you have to have free movement. So it's partly a question of our politics. It's partly, too, tied up with the negotiations that we're yet to begin with our European partners as to what we can do. The other thing to bear in mind is the Conservatives in power have been talking about reducing immigration since 2010, and they've set themselves ambitious targets for reduction of immigration into the UK, and yet they have failed to control even immigration from outside the EU, which is completely within their remit, and that makes up more than half of the immigration into our country. So there are very real constraints in the way of attempts to control this.
Is there, David, a scenario in which... I mean, we heard her on tape saying people from outside the UK who are there now because of its EU membership can stay. I think that's what she said. Is there a situation in which they do get pushed out? They're no longer allowed to stay. And what are the implications of that for the British economy?
Well, there's about 3 million people in Britain at the moment who are born in other EU member states. So to put that in contrast, that's out of 60 million. So that's it's a bit like having 15 million people in the United States under that status. There's about just over 1 million Brits living elsewhere in the European Union. So there clearly is a kind of negotiation already there about what you do. I think one of the big problems with this that Theresa May faces as the Conservative leader is that there is a political mismatch between the leaders of the successful Brexit campaign and the voters. A lot of the leaders, particularly in her party, the Conservative Party, they're kind of romantic, libertarian, free market kind of liberals who have this vision of Britain that would be a sort of low tax, low regulations of Singapore of the North, zooming about the oceans, trading with the world. And if you ask them what their view is of immigration, they say, oh, you know, we don't particularly need fewer immigrants. We just need to have control so that we can pick and choose the best immigrants. We'll be like sort of Canada or Australia with a kind of clever points system. But these people have led what is effectively a kind of Trump-style, blue-collar, working-class, anti-globalization, anti-immigration revolt. And so you have a mismatch between the people at the front of the kind of lynch mob and then the kind of the torch-wielding mob behind them, who, if they don't see a big change to immigration policy, they're going to feel that they've been lied to and they've been cheated because they think they've just voted for the world to be kind of told to go away.
Stephanie, in Boston, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I've just got a quick comment and a quick question about this. I don't understand why it is so inevitable that EU and all the members, you know, has to go for tighter and tighter integrations, both politically and in terms of monetary policy. Why is it that it is not possible to have a common market like what EEA used to be 20, 30 years ago? And why is it that it has to be a single market? All this, from my perspective, is just man-made construct, and it's all up for negotiation. It is easier for the elites to say, well, you know, of course, it's easier to just give up whatever, you know, for the benefits. But, you know, from my perspective, and also I think most of the people in the Leave campaign, is the elites and the politicians need to work harder to negotiate for better terms for Britain, and not just by giving up everything and coming back with so little.
Stephanie, we've got it. Thank you. David Rennie, what about it? Room here, could you see Britain's exit ultimately loosening all of the kind of cohesion that our caller Stephanie says may have grown tighter than justified?
Look, Stephanie gives voice to absolutely a big chunk of British opinion. Remember that, you know, when we first joined the club 43 years ago, we were a grumpy, awkward member who kind of backed into it late mm-hmm. after it was already up and running because we thought the continent was more dynamic economically. And so we kind of joined grudgingly. And everything that she has just said about why does it have to keep getting deeper? Why do we have to have more and more political union? Why can't it just be a kind of trading deal? That's absolutely where I suspect most British people are and what they feel. But the problem is, it's a club of 28, and Britain is pretty much an outlier on that side. And it's always been, you know, for my magazine, The Economist, you know, we don't necessarily think that the idea is more Europe all the time, and that's always been a kind of problem. But here's the thing, if the majority of countries on the other side of the English Channel do want to start having a single currency and integrating, Britain has a choice. You know, do we think that on balance we're better off being part of that reluctantly or walking away from it? And that's the choice. You know, we can't, as on our own as the UK, dictate what the EU turns into. And we would argue that actually, over the years, the Europe's been pretty pragmatic about letting us not be a member of the single currency. We still use yep. the pound and pence, not mm-hmm. the euro. We're not a member of their borderless thing called the Schengen Treaty, where you can go from France to Germany without a passport. You have to show a passport mm-hmm. To cross into the UK. So we've been given a ton of opt-outs, and actually Europe was getting more pragmatic about not bullying us to be a member of every single inner circle. And now we've walked away. We would argue that we're throwing away the benefits and assuming there'll be no costs.
Sabrina in Augusta, Georgia. Sabrina, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a German citizen who actually owns property. I own a farm in Yorkshire, England. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened was that once Brexit went through, a lot of my friends called me up and said, what does this mean for you? Does this mean you'll have to sell the farm? Does this mean you'll be kicked out of England? And I've been there for years.
Yeah.
And actually, I just have no idea. And that's kind of the scary part, where you don't know where you're going to be in the next 6 months to a year.
You and a lot of others. Sabrina, may I ask you, as a German then, how do you feel about how Europe ought to treat Britain on this side of the Brexit vote? Do you want Europe to be tough with Britain or to make accommodations to keep them outside the organization, but in the fold? What's your attitude?
Well, I think that Germany is basically very tough with the other members of the EU country, and they're kind of coming from, well, we're doing just fine and we can do it, so why can't you? So I think one of the things is asking a German how we should get along in the EU is like, it's obvious. It has a historical basis. It's not just economic. And I think we've forgotten how the EU first started.
You mean why it came about partly out of the urge for peace, to reduce conflict and have more unity?
Yeah, Exactly. So I think that's one of the big things, is that we've kind of forgotten it in the muddle, like who owes what to whom and what should we do in this instance. But I think the biggest thing is to have a united front against enemies, both past, present, and future.
NATO remains, but it has a different flavor without EU membership and the cohesion behind it. I appreciate your call. Interesting to hear that uncertainty, even right now, from a German with property in England. Bob is calling from Truro, Massachusetts. Robert Kuttner, editor of the American Prospect, calling from Truro, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. You know, I've made the argument that as the implications of this become clearer and clearer and clearer, the new prime minister could possibly conclude that his public opinion has changed. She could pitch this to the House of Commons to approve the Article 50 process authorizing these negotiations. And since about two out of three, or maybe even three out of four members of the House of Commons, as individuals, are opposed to this, they could deny her that authority. Now, would that be the Tory party committing suicide in a different way, or is that plausible to our British friends?
It's a great question. I'll put it to both. Anand Menon, first to you. I mean, we heard her say on tape, Brexit means Brexit, but what about a way out of it?
Well, there are several things to be said there. Firstly, she's under no compulsion to go to the House of Commons before triggering Article 50.
But perhaps she could, Bob is suggesting, and with that create an exit ramp.
The danger then is you set the politicians against the people. And it's not a very pretty sight in a democracy if your parliament votes against something that the people, in what was a huge democratic moment in our country.
Yeah.
I mean, for all the doubts about the campaigns, we had a very high turnout, and the majority of those who turned out, 17 million people, said they want to leave. If our parliament after that turns around and says, you know what, we're not going to do it, we think you made the wrong decision, the implications for the future of our politics and our democracy, I suspect, will be quite ugly.
David, how about you? Others have said, well, maybe another referendum, or maybe take it to the House of Commons. Any way off the Brexit path?
So I think the specific idea that Theresa May could use the House of Commons to kind of back out of this, the reason that doesn't quite work is that your caller is absolutely right, that there is probably a majority in the House of Commons that doesn't particularly want to leave the European Union. But that's not true of the Conservative Party that Theresa May leads. She would be relying on votes from the other opposition parties to win that vote. And so she would effectively be falling on her sword. I mean, we've had enough governments falling recently that maybe another one could fall, but she would be basically torn apart by her own Conservative Party, because there is a thumping majority in the Conservative Party, certainly among activists, for Brexit. The Conservative Party is a party dominated by Brexit. Now, where it gets more interesting is if in 2 or 3 or 4 years' time the negotiations are an absolute nightmare and gigantic multinationals like Nissan are closing factories and Britain feels very, very different. Now, at that point, does another general election start to feel like effectively a referendum on a do-over? Do we start to see kind of calls for something that isn't explicitly a kind of second vote telling us to vote again and get it right this time, but something that everyone understands is a kind of vote to, you know, endorse something that isn't quite Brexit?
Mm-hmm.
There you could imagine some wriggle room. But, I mean, even there, it's a really interesting question. Would Theresa May call an early election? She's walked into this office in this strange British way that you just go and have a cup of tea with the Queen and kiss hands and you're Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
She could be Prime Minister till 2020 without an election by law. Whether she calls an early election is probably in the short run based on whether she thinks she would pick up more seats and thump Labour in that process. But you could imagine an election being triggered at some point that is effectively a referendum on where we've got to in the Europe negotiations.
Sarah in Springfield, Illinois. Sarah, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I was just kind of wondering if I could ask your guests about what their views are on sort of the EU immediate response to the British referendum in wanting to really push for fast negotiations before they even had another prime minister. And I heard a lot of talk about like kind of making an example of them and like so that no other countries would try to do the same thing. And it really made me nervous. So I was just wondering if I could get some perspective, because I'm very new to international politics.
Anand, an urge to punish by the rest of the EU here. And will that hold up? Because they might have an interest in England, Britain not becoming a basket case themselves.
Absolutely. I think there are lots of conflicting urges here. The word that you heard a lot of around the time of the referendum was contagion. That's to say, the worry that now that Britain's voted to leave, there will be people in all the other member states who say, oh, we can leave as well. So certainly the other member states aren't interested in giving us a deal that looks so attractive that their own Eurosceptics turn around and say, oh, I'd like a bit of that, please. Mm-hmm. That looks far better than membership. You gave it to the British, give it to us. That will definitely be in their minds. So I think that gives them a real incentive to stick to their rules. So when they say, if you want single market access, you have to have free movement of people, one very good reason why they're not going to give ground on that is, if they do, the Danes will turn around the next day and say, we'd like to be like the British people. We'd like to have the market without the people. So I think fear of contagion will shape the negotiations, and it will make them rather less flexible in dealing with our demands than they might otherwise have been.
Sobering days ahead. One more call. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Despite some superficial similarities between Theresa May and Angela Merkel, do you think they can really have a constructive relationship despite their differences, especially on immigration, to help the process move forward?
Low-key women, preachers, daughters. What about these two, David, and their likely relationship?
So it's an important point that links into your last quarter as well about will Britain be punished? Germany is by far the most important player in this. You will hear voices from places like the European Parliament saying very shrill things about punishing Britain and not giving Britain anything. But Angela Merkel and Germany, they don't want Britain to end up miles and miles away, not just for economic reasons, but when I was covering the European Union for The Economist, and I used to write our Europe column out of Brussels, I remember going to the Kanzler and to the Chancellery in Berlin with a bunch of reporters, and we met Angela Merkel for an off-the-record meeting. And it was very clear at that point, because Britain was already sort of making trouble, she didn't want Britain to leave, because there are broadly two camps in the European Union in terms of views of globalization. One led by the British, which is more outward-looking, free trading, you know, take advantage if you can of globalization. There's another camp broadly led by the French, which is, let's try and push globalization away by uniting as tightly as we can as Europeans and sort of building a fortress Europe. Angela Merkel wants to be the swing voter between those two camps. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to side with either one of the two. And if Britain leaves, then the large voice for kind of open, free trading globalism has left the table. And she is left on her own at the table with the French and the Southern Europeans. And that's not a comfortable position for her. So she will try, I think, to do what she can to help Theresa May out, but not at any cost.
Anand Menon, riven is the word you used about the internal dynamics of Britain right now. Where's the healing begin there? Just half a minute here, Anand.
Well, it's very, very hard to see, because one of the problems we have is, whilst all this is going on, our other major political party is doing a sort of stand-up act of falling apart, not managing to change its leader,
Labour,
or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are large parts of the country that are traditional Labour strongholds now that the far-right UKIP party thinks are up for grabs for it. So I think we've got a long way to go before we get anywhere down the route towards healing, to be honest.
Anand Menon, director of the UK in a Changing Europe initiative. Anand, thank you so much for being with us today from Manchester, England.
Been a pleasure.
David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist out of London. David, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your thoughts and calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.